How long do you have to take steroids if you have COPD?
Turning a ventilation upside down.
Fine-tuning who benefits from prostate cancer treatment again.
Would you be shocked to know that athletes with defibrillators can participate in sports?
Boo.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the breaking medical news from Johns Hopkins. This will be posted on May 24th, 2013. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
All right. I had to just boo about would you be shocked? So I think we should turn right to circulation. A study taking a look at implanted cardiodefibrillators and whether folks can participate in sports following that implantation.
This stems from the statements from the American College of Cardiology and the European Society for Cardiology that actually advise against sports participation in anything that's more vigorous than bowling or golf for individuals that have had an implantable cardiodefibrillator, or what we're going to call an ICD. But that's really with no firm foundation. So this was an interesting study. It was a multinational registry where they surveyed athletes between the ages of 10 and 60 years old who participated in either organized or high-risk sports. And they followed them for an average of 31 months. Were these athletes more likely to die? And then they asked how often did they have defibrillation episodes during or after sports or even at rest. So they looked at almost 400 individuals participating in a variety of sports. And what they determined was that there were no occurrences of death or suffering a cardiac arrest that needed resuscitation or even a shock-related injury during sports. What the authors conclude is that the athletes with ICDs can engage in vigorous and competitive sports.
This is good news, of course, because we're all very fond of vigorous physical activity in order to preserve our cardiac functions. Once again, I have to say I admire these folks for taking the risk when the risk is really unknown to participate in these kinds of sports and allow themselves to be assessed.
This was interesting because they didn't encourage people to participate in sports. These are people that already had the defibrillator, and their life choice was they were going to continue. Many of these individuals signed up not because they were aware of any particular study, but because they were involved with many of these support groups. And these support groups made this study known, and the individuals participated as a result of this. In fact, over half the participants in North America became aware of this through this community-based participatory research.
Kind of a cool story. Let's turn from here then to the one I'm going to talk about this week in the blog, and that is acute respiratory distress syndrome and whether people in the ICU ought to be on their stomachs or on their backs, that's supine or prone, and what impact that has on survival. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine.
This condition, acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS, is basically lung injury that results in decreased oxygenation of the blood, obviously be a fatal condition. This is an interesting study that looked at whether positioning people face down as opposed to on their back could actually improve their outcome. So they studied this in a prospective randomized trial where they took 466 patients with severe ARDS and they randomized them to ventilation in the standard way or prone. And what they discovered was that patients positioned in the prone position had a markedly improved survival. At the end of 28 days, those that were ventilated in the prone position, their mortality was 16%. Those in the supine position, it was 33%. There was a 61% decrease in the risk of death with prone ventilation.
And we've talked way back when about CPR on either the ventral aspect or the dorsal aspect, and that in fact, you can do it dorsally and do really well.
With CPR, what you're trying to do is increase the thoracic pressure. With ventilation, what happens is you actually improve oxygenation. So you can show that the individuals that are ventilated in the prone position, it improves their oxygenation. Now, the interesting thing is this mortality benefit was noticed immediately within the first 48 hours and sustained over a period of 28 to 90 days. Now, the caveat is this is not easy to do. It requires teamwork. As a result, the New England Journal of Medicine put a video on to demonstrate to physicians and care teams how this can be successfully accomplished.
I think this is particularly important also for two other reasons. One is that ARDS is a common sequela or complication of severe flus, and we are certainly looking for that kind of a flu to make its way across the globe. So figuring out how to manage these people better is obviously an important point. And the other thing is that I think it tests once again this idea that a priori, we think we know what the right way is to manage somebody. And oops, when we subject this to some kind of rigorous scrutiny, we find out that it may be counterintuitive.
Right. And this is kind of a two-pronged message. One to physicians that are caring for people with ARDS. For those with severe ARDS, early in the disease process, prone ventilation can improve their survival. To family members who may have an individual in the intensive care unit, you walk in and suddenly you look at your friend or relative and they're face down. You say, what in the world's going on? Well, what's going on is we're trying to improve their survival.
So on that note then, let us switch. Let's go to, as far as improving survival, Annals of Internal Medicine. I served it up as, once again, fine-tuning who benefits from prostate cancer treatment.
I thought this was an important contribution. And I know every time I say there's another prostate cancer study, you roll your eyes at me, Elizabeth. But here's why I think this is important. We are putting more of this in the hands of the individual deciding what they should pursue. And the only way to really be able to do that is to tell somebody, what's your risk of dying from prostate cancer as opposed to dying with prostate cancer? So what this particular study did was it looked at the effect of the patient's age, the comorbidities, that is other medical conditions they might have, and also the aggressiveness of the tumor. And here's what they discovered. When you look at comorbidities, things like heart disease or liver disease or kidney disease, if men who are already diagnosed with prostate cancer have none of those, the risk of dying of a non-prostate disease is only 24%. If they have three or more of those, the risk is about 60%. What about with respect to age? For men that have three or more comorbid medical conditions, their 10-year risk of dying of something other than prostate cancer, if they're younger than 60 years old, is about 26%. But if they're over age 75, it's about 71%. So what this tells us is that older men with multiple comorbidities are at high risk of dying for things other than prostate cancer within 10 years of diagnosis.
We've been pounding public health messaging to get men to come in and be screened, and subsequently, of course, then they're treated. So I think it's like turning the Titanic to now communicate the message that, oops, there's a bunch of other things that you really need to consider before you undertake treatment for prostate cancer. The other thing I would say is that I think we're also seeing this emerging with regard to breast cancer screening, detection, and subsequent treatment. And a similar situation where we really need to take a look at the evidence base and see what happens as a result of screening, how much overtreatment and subsequent morbidity is there related to that.
This is a very emotionally charged issue, because when you talk about cancer screening, everybody's going to raise their hand and say, oh, well, yes, definitely we should be screening for cancer. You have to look at, is your test effective? Do you catch it at an early enough stage where you have effective treatment that can actually change their mortality? And are they going to die from their cancer for some unrelated issue? All of these have to be considered into the issue of whether we're going to screen somebody or not.
Well, you gave me a very nice segue into our final study this week. That's in the journal, the American Medical Association, taking a look at short versus long-term corticosteroids in the management of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
COPD, or emphysema, is usually a manifestation of long-time cigarette smoking. Once people get COPD, they oftentimes have exacerbations. We know that about a fourth of individuals with COPD actually experience an exacerbation that requires therapy, and that obviously leads to increased mortality as well. So the question is, when you have someone with a COPD exacerbation, how best to treat it? This study took 314 patients who were either current or previous cigarette smokers. They all had COPD, and they presented with an exacerbation, and they randomized them to either 5 days of steroids or 7 to 14 day course. And they followed those individuals over the next 6 months, saying how likely were they to have another exacerbation. And what they discovered over following over 6 months is there was no difference in the short steroid versus the longer steroid treatment course.
And you know how very fond I am of, let's just do this as long as we have to and absolutely no more, particularly with regard to corticosteroid treatment.
Because there are side effects associated with those. High blood pressure, for example, with diabetes. It can also be associated with other conditions, something called avascular necrosis. So there are a lot of possible side effects. And so the shorter that we can limit the therapy and get away with it, that is treat effectively, the better off we are.
Excellent. On that good news note then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.